What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. The intersection of immigration, border enforcement, new technology, and specifically artificial intelligence is racing toward more intense and more violent border enforcement strategies that are fueled by problematic algorithms. Algorithms that mostly replicate the social and economic systems of power and exclusion that Western societies are rooted in. On today's show, we'll explore part of how exclusionary and violent border policies have been aided by artificial intelligence, not just in the U.S., but around the world, and how, because border policies are slower to develop than technology, artificial intelligence industries move these practices forward without regulation and in global concert among the world's wealthier states. I'm joined today by Petra Molnar, a lawyer and anthropologist specializing in the impacts of migration technologies. She co-runs the Refugee Law Lab at York University and the Migration Technology Monitor, which funds community-grounded projects on border tech. She's also the author of the book that we'll be discussing today, called The Walls Have Eyes: Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Petra Molnar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is our pleasure, although we are discussing some dark times. Before we get into the storytelling in your book, I want to start by just framing the broader conversation. I want to define what's referred to in your book as digital border violence. It's aided not only by technology, but specifically artificial intelligence. What even is a digital border, and how does it lead to violence?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start because there's so much violence and issues that happen at borders already. But what we've been seeing in the last number of years is this rise of digital technologies that are exacerbating the ways that borders are difficult for people, in the sense that there is more surveillance, more automation, different types of experimental projects that have been introduced to kind of augment the ways that borders are policed, the way that people on the move are criminalized, and again, kind of playing into the violent policies that are a daily reality for people who are crossing borders.
And what even are we talking about when we're talking about artificial intelligence in this kind of context, as opposed to, say, just technology?
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right that the line is very blurry. And I think the term artificial intelligence is used in really particular ways these days. It's really like the sexy topic in vogue that everybody is concerned about. But, and you know, myself as well, right? Like, I put the term artificial intelligence on the cover of my book when it's in fact not really about AI, but rather the kind of social impacts of technology writ large. But I think it is fair to say that the advent of more and more automation and algorithmic decision making and machine learning has exacerbated a lot of the issues that I try and cover in my book, in terms of, for example, how decision making is changing when we start augmenting or replacing human decision making with machine learning. So, you know, when we're trying to define something as broad and amorphous as artificial intelligence, it really, you know, depends who you talk to. Some people take very conservative definitions. In my work, I take a more expansive definition of AI to encapsulate as many technologies as possible to then be able to critique them from a human rights perspective. But I think you're absolutely right. The line really there is quite blurry. And we also have to, I think, criticize rightly this kind of obsession with AI that we're seeing everywhere, right? It is this kind of term in vogue, you know, that a lot of powerful actors are also misusing. So it's important to always critique, like, what exactly even is being done and how intelligent is it even really, right? But ultimately, it is about trying to understand the kind of ecosystem in which these technologies develop and what is even termed artificial intelligence and for what purposes.
And how are algorithms used in this context? I mean, I think in kind of pop culture, we hear about algorithms very frequently. But when you talk about something like you just did, augmenting human decision making with machine learning or machine decision making, and I'll ask you for examples of that. But how are algorithms working in this context? And I want to read just one sentence that I copied down from your writing, that technology is presented as being neutral, but it is always socially constructed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, technology is a social construct. It is something that's constructed in our world, like language, like law, and it reflects the values and the power differentials that are inherent in our world that is very divided. You know, when you asked about algorithmic decision making in particular, this is actually where my work in this started. Back in 2018, in Canada, you know, before this, and I think it's important to reflect on this too, you know, I'm not a technologist by training, right? I'm a refugee lawyer, an anthropologist, and, you know, 10 years ago, I barely knew what an algorithm was. Like, we're talking Wikipedia level knowledge, right? Uh-huh. You know, I was representing people in the immigration detention system in Canada, like really working frontline. But through a series of, you know, misadventures, a colleague of mine and I discovered that the Canadian government was using algorithms to change the way that decisions were being done in Canada's immigration system, primarily visa triaging. So basically making decisions about whether or not the government was going to grant a visa to somebody coming from certain target countries. And none of this was publicly discussed. There didn't seem to be a conversation about the human rights impacts, the data impacts, or even just an understanding of what the algorithms were actually doing. And yeah, that's how my work started in this area. It kind of really opened my eyes to this introduction of algorithmic decision-making and machine learning, which again, are decision-making systems that rely on vast amounts of data that are pumped into the system to then make determinations, kind of like a recipe of programmable steps, so to speak. But if we know, again, that the world is biased and discriminatory and biased data is being fed into these algorithms, that's where a lot of the concerns are coming from.
Well, and one of the concerns that was so heavily raised in this part of your book where you described how you got into this work in Canada is that the public only found out about this AI system of automated triaging of immigration applications after a federal court decision in Canada. How are these technological developments engaged by border enforcement and border policy in ways that we don't know about, not only don't know about, but can't learn about?
Yeah, that's such an important piece to this whole story, Jesse. The fact that so much of this happens behind closed doors and the fact that there doesn't seem to be a commitment to public transparency and accountability, even in terms of making it publicly known what governments are experimenting with. And absolutely, you know, in various Canadian cases, the only reason why the public learned about some of these technologies is because lawyers noticed something amiss with their client's decision that, you know, they read it and they're like, this doesn't really seem like a human wrote this. You know, the fact that, again, governments are playing around with this kind of technology without any kind of discussion with the public is really quite disturbing, actually. And not to mention, again, when we talk about the populations that are at the sharpest edges of this kind of development, you know, there's already a lot of disenfranchisement there. Sometimes people don't even have lawyers, right, in their cases, let alone the knowledge to determine whether or not some sort of, you know, high-risk technology is being applied to their case. And this can have really drastic results. Your cases can be denied. People have been deported as a result. For example, in the UK, 7,000 students were wrongfully deported because an algorithm accused them of cheating on a test. You know, imagine you're one of these students and you want to challenge this somehow. It gets very, very complicated. And a lot of the times people don't even know that this technology is being applied against them.
Right. And in theory, you can challenge that in a court, but that has so much to do with what types of resources you have in order to do that. Petra, so much of your book is kind of a ethnographic framing of different border areas. And that really brought me as a reader into a grounded sense of how these technologies are being kind of operationalized in different contexts. So I'm hoping we can walk through some of those stories and start close to our home here in California, looking at the southern border. In the first chapter of your book, you're exploring the U.S.-Mexico border in the Sonoran Desert, alongside someone named James Holman.
You know, the whole book really is a commitment to being present in the spaces where these technologies are being played out. And, James Holman and his search and rescue group called the Battalion Search and Rescue were such a key part to this story. So James is a former Marine who has lived in Arizona for many years and felt compelled to start a search and rescue group after seeing the violence that's happening at the border and coming across people in distress in the Sonoran Desert, you know, after days and days of walking. And James and I had a chance to go into the Sonora together back in 2022, and recently I saw him again in May. But in 2022, that was also when, I have to say, probably one of the most surreal moments in my career happened. And, you know, if you choose to read the book, you'll see I've had many. When we were on the sands of the Sonora, which, by the way, is such a beautiful place, but it's also very deadly. I mean, it's a very sharp, inhospitable environment. We were going and trekked for hours into the desert to visit a memorial site of a gentleman by the name of Elias Alvarado, who was a young husband and father from Central America who, you know, like so many people, wanted a chance for a better life and also was exercising his internationally protected right to asylum and came to the United States and unfortunately passed away in the Sonora Desert, just, you know, a few kilometers away from a major highway. And while we were there, you know, on the sands of the Sonora, the Department of Homeland Security in February of 2022 publicly announced that, you know, drones and AI towers and ground sensors are not enough, that they wanted a new piece of technology to augment what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. And they announced that robo-dogs are now going to be joining this arsenal of technology. And so on one hand, you know, you see the kind of the human impact quite literally in the desert, while being faced with government announcements that this kind of, frankly, draconian sci-fi technology is going to be used in these spaces. And you just can't help but wonder, like, will people like Mr. Alvarado be chased by robo-dogs? It is this dichotomy there that's really difficult to sit with when you spend time in these spaces.
One of the things that's difficult for me to totally grasp when we're talking about these technologies is it's one thing for the government to arm itself with these various things like a robo-dog. It's another thing to imagine how they will actually be used.
And that's a really, really good point, because there is also a gap in terms of the kind of, you know, almost like surveillance and security theater that goes into these announcements and these press releases and you know, fancy videos about all this tech, and then actually seeing it play out at the border. You know, with the robo-dogs, it's still not totally clear in what capacity they're being used at the border. But interestingly enough, just this year at the Border Expo, which is like a big conference of private sector actors, you know, that are selling their wares, so to speak, to the government, my colleague Todd Miller, who writes for the Border Chronicle in Arizona, wrote about seeing robo-dogs at this Border Expo, robo-dogs that belong to companies like AT&T and Verizon. So it is kind of interesting, right, to see also these different actors that are now coming on board and saying, hey, we're part of this industry too, and we are developing this technology as well for the purposes of border enforcement. But it is a good reminder that, you know, there is also a lot of stories to be told in that kind of gap when it comes to the implementation of the technology, which is something that I saw in different contexts around the world as well.
As we move through some of these different stories, I'm also going to be asking you about the different technologies. But for listeners who are not familiar and perhaps surprised, what is a robo-dog?
Yeah. So, you know, a robo-dog might be familiar to the sci-fi fans who are listening in. They've appeared on shows like The Black Mirror. But they're essentially a quadruped, four-legged, military-grade piece of technology that doesn't really look like a dog, but it's like a four-legged robot that can, you know, traverse difficult terrain. Maybe people have seen videos from, for example, Boston Dynamics, one of the key companies that has been developing robots and robo-dogs. But it is, again, this kind of piece of technology that is autonomous and autonomously making decisions, in difficult environments, for example, and in this case being presented as kind of augmenting the border enforcement apparatus at the U.S.-Mexico border.
And you're listening to Law & Disorder on KPFA Radio. We're in conversation with Petra Molnar, a lawyer and anthropologist specializing on the impacts of migration technologies. Her book is called The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Petra, your book takes us from Mexico then to Greece, where the current prime minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, made extending the border wall part of his election bid in his 2023 re-election campaign. What does the European border look like from Greece, and how is it enforced?
So Greece is one of the epicenters, I would say, of a lot of migration policymaking and also this kind of introduction of new surveillance technologies. Greece has for a number of years been functioning as what it's been termed as really in policy documents is Europe's shield, in the sense that it is, you know, at the kind of geographic frontier of the European Union and has also been receiving many, many people who have been escaping, for example, the Syria war, people from Afghanistan, people from Palestine, and housing people in camps, for example, in refugee camps along the, for example, Aegean frontier on the islands there. And Greece has been getting a lot of money also from the European Union to accomplish these tasks of building new camps, of introducing more surveillance, of gathering more data on people who are arriving. And this has resulted in the construction of new refugee camps that are replete with all sorts of technology. And it's also resulted in more and more surveillance being used to police the land border, Evros, between Greece and Turkey, but also the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And again, you know, it has also, I think, been a reminder for all of us how politicians are able to use this specter and fear of migration for political gains, in this case, a re-election campaign by Prime Minister Mitsotakis.
I think our listeners hear a lot about the U.S.-Mexico border, and we hear about the technologies used there in some contexts, but we hear very little about the borders of Europe. Sometimes we hear about asylum seekers, but can you bring our listeners in with a conversation framing it with Frontex?
Yeah, that's right. So Frontex is essentially the European Union's border force. It is an agency that is kind of like a third actor, so to speak, because it's, you know, it's not a state and it's not a private sector actor, but it's an agency of the European Union to enforce the border. And this means that they can have a really kind of vast ambit of their power. They can police, they can surveil, they can gather data, they can arrest. And unfortunately, they've also been implicated in illegal pushback operations. Pushbacks are essentially anything that prevents a person from entering European territory to claim asylum and is illegal under international law because people are allowed to come to a place and claim asylum. But entities like Frontex have been using, for example, surveillance to make determinations about where people are coming from to then tow them back to Turkish territory. They've also been implicated in, unfortunately, deaths in the Mediterranean and Aegean Sea as a result of preventing people from entering into European territory. And on the tech side, they've been a major player in kind of normalizing technology and being very proud of using AI and algorithms and predictive analytics very, very publicly to kind of bolster the powers that they already have.
And some of those programs are called Fold Out, or there's another one, I believe, called iBorder Control that I learned about from your book. I'm wondering if you can share some of the details of what those specific programs are for. One thing that really caught me off guard was the idea of AI lie detecting at the border.
Yeah, so that so-called AI lie detector is the iBorder Control project. And I always make this comment, but I find the names so interesting, right? Because it's like you have an iPad, an iPhone, and now you have iBorder Control.
Right. And for listeners, the way it's spelled is like that. It's with a lowercase I and a capital B, iBorder.
Yeah. So the iBorder Control was actually a research project funded under this big research scheme in the European Union called Horizon 2020, and this will become important later. But it was a project that tried to essentially create an AI lie detector that used facial recognition and emotion recognition analysis to make determinations about whether or not you're lying at the border. hugely problematic, right? And people have rightly critiqued this project as just being nothing more than snake oil. Like, it just doesn't even work the way it's intended. But when it hit the media, you know, a lot of us were just even shocked that, A, this was developed under the guise of being a pilot project or a research project, because it was also targeting very specific countries, Hungary and Greece, which are major interdiction points for people coming into Europe. But, you know, from a refugee lawyer perspective, like, how can an AI lie detector deal with differences in cross-cultural communication, for example? You know, when I was a lawyer in Canada, I represented people in court who had maybe trouble making eye contact with a decision maker of the opposite gender because of religion, because of their experiences, or maybe just because of nerves. Or maybe more subtly even, what about the impact of trauma on memory? Mm. And the fact that we know that we don't tell stories in a linear way anyway. Like, human decision makers struggle with this so much and make very problematic determinations about people's plausibility and truthfulness. So much of this is also predicated on racism, discrimination, misunderstanding of cultures. Like, how can an AI lie detector that, again, is socially constructed in our current reality, how can an AI lie detector at the border deal with these complexities of human movement and human life in general? It's really disturbing that also, yeah, these projects are even just being introduced and thought of.
Well, and of course, there's the question, we touched on it earlier, but do these people who are seeking refuge, certainly not necessarily familiar with the languages of the places they're arriving to, do these folks understand the technological process that they're being put through by any means?
Yeah. And I mean, understanding is one thing and the ability to opt out is another. A lot of the ways that the technologies are being introduced and kind of pushed on people really makes us think about what informed consent even means in these spaces, right? And our ability to opt out. I mean, you know, listeners might be familiar now with all sorts of technology at U.S. airports, for example, right? Facial recognition, yes. You know, even facial recognition at the gate. So you don't even have to interact with a gate agent. And usually somewhere there's a little paragraph that says, if you're uncomfortable, you can opt out. But it's difficult to do that, right? When you're at the airport, you're maybe wanting to get home to your family, or you just don't feel comfortable interacting with the border apparatus. Now imagine that you're a refugee or you're at the border about to claim asylum and, you know, you are having to interact with this technology that you might not even understand, and you feel like, well, I can't say no to it, right? These are, again, the kind of vast power differentials that are so inherent in this space that people don't really think about.
That's right. And again, we're in conversation with Petra Molnar, a lawyer and anthropologist specializing on the impacts of migration technologies, talking about her book called The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Petra, you have a chapter whose even the title really hit me. Title is Data is the New Oil. We know in this day and age that data is and data collection is such a driving force behind a lot of the technologies that we use. It is certainly a driving force behind all of the artificial intelligence technologies. I'm wondering if in the context of border enforcement, if you can talk about how analytics and the algorithms that use that data are monetized in processes that lead to violence.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, thanks for making reference to the chapter title. That actually comes from a colleague of mine, Mariam Jamal, who does amazing work on data justice in Kenya. And I think it really encapsulates a lot of the kind of economics behind this verve of more data is always better. More, you know, data is the new oil, really. Because, you know, we've been talking a lot about algorithms and surveillance and all sorts of, you know, technological systems, but they all rely on data sets. They cannot function without them. And trying to kind of understand the global political economy that's grown up around this need for data also then kind of breaks down along, again, lines of power. A lot of this data is extracted from populations that have been historically disenfranchised, whether, you know, because of their migration status, also because of their geographic location. You know, we're seeing a lot of data centers in East Africa, in the Middle East region, again, kind of fueling this surveillance economy that the West really benefits a lot from.
I might go as far as to say, from what I learned in your book, that this type of data collection is used by governments to maintain power differentials.
Absolutely. And these are some of the broader logics that really underpin, you know, what we innovate on and why. The fact that so much of it is about keeping the status quo of power the way it is, right? The fact that, you know, North America and Europe in particular benefits from creating this global surveillance apparatus that keeps certain people away, people who have been deemed unworthy, unwelcome, you know, threats, frauds, the ultimate other, while allowing freedom of movement for others, right? It is all along these kind of lines of privilege and power that these systems really of technological oppression operate on. And it absolutely breaks down along, you know, the kind of lines of influence that we've been seeing historically in this space.
Now, Petra, your next chapter in the book goes to Israel and looks at Israeli border policy. Our listeners are pretty familiar with border policy of Israel. I think it's worthwhile to talk specifically about the border, not just about the genocide and how AI has been implemented there. But Israel not only has a massive border wall, it also controls Palestinian Wi-Fi and has a vast network of biometric surveillance, including things like facial recognition cameras at checkpoints. What does that look like, and how does it impact Palestinians from specifically a border control context? And then we'll talk about how AI is being empowered by the genocide.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so Israel is such a major player in the development of surveillance technology and technology that curtails Palestinian movement. And, you know, when we're trying to kind of understand the impacts of this tech, it really ultimately is about supporting an apartheid regime that prevents Palestinians from being able to leave the occupied West Bank, for example. Or if they try and leave, you know, on valid travel documents, they face incredible scrutiny either at the airport or through, you know, the land crossing that they can take into Jordan. There are other areas that are essentially completely occupied. For example, the occupied city of Hebron, which is one of the places that I visited in the spring of 2023, to see some of this surveillance firsthand. I mean, you know, when you're in a place like Hebron, you can't help but feel the kind of omnipresent surveillance that's there, whether that is, you know, drone surveillance. There's also autonomous weapons, you know, at different crossing points. But there's also kind of geographic segregation, what have been called sterilized roads, for example, where Palestinians just cannot enter. And so it creates this kind of labyrinthine way that Palestinian daily life is so curtailed. You know, not to mention Gaza and the fact that even before the start of the genocide, it was essentially an open air prison. And technologies, again, have been a major, major way that these policies have been able to be enacted on Palestinians and to kind of create these borders that are essentially impossible to cross.
Okay, I want to rewind for one moment because you made a quick reference to AI weapons at checkpoints. Of all things that I can imagine AI having power over, perhaps the most humbling is the ability for AI to make a decision to shoot a gun at a human being. I'm wondering if you can talk in a little bit more detail about what those AI weapons at checkpoints actually are.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're part of this kind of arsenal of technologies that Israel has been developing, essentially making autonomous decisions about whether or not to target anybody that is deemed suspicious. And, you know, you really feel that kind of power when you're there. You just don't know what's going to happen when you're close to these checkpoints, for example. This is also similar to what happens in Gaza with the AI targeting, which has been called out in, you know, a lot of the international conversations, UN documents that have, you know, been pushing the conversation and determining, you know, that what Israel is doing is a tech-facilitated genocide, essentially.
Well, let's be specific in that. How is Israel using tech to facilitate the genocide?
Well, so Israel, from, you know, October 7th onwards, has been very open about the use of technology to target Palestinians and to kill them, essentially, in Gaza, right? And often a lot of the technology is talked about in very kind of soft terms. You know, if you look up the names of these projects, you know, there's the Gospel, Lavender, all of these are targeting systems that pick out people who are going to essentially be exterminated. And again, with AI and autonomous weaponry, the exponential reach of the weaponry is just so much more than if you had a human officer executing the orders, right, that were put out. And so that's one of the main concerns. When you start introducing autonomous weapons into warfare, the sheer scale of impact is just, it can, you know, be extraordinary. And we have seen this in Gaza. It's essentially indiscriminate targeting of Palestinians for the genocidal ends of Israel.
And my understanding, and please correct me if you have any different understanding, but my understanding is that Israel is using the genocide as well as its general border policy and border program as kind of an experimental ground for some of these technologies in order to build up their economy and market them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we're seeing like really the sharpest manifestation of what is happening in Gaza, but this predates this current situation, right? Israel has been testing out technology in occupied Palestinian territories for years, quote unquote, battle testing it, and then selling it for other purposes around the world. This is how we end up, for example, with Israeli Heron drones in the Mediterranean for border enforcement, or Elbit Systems Towers, it's another Israeli company, at the U.S.-Mexico border. Israel has just become such a major player in this worldwide border industry that has grown up around this quote-unquote need to create a solution to the problem of migration. You know, and if listeners are interested, there was a really interesting book that came out at the end of 2023 by Jewish journalist Anthony Lewinstein called The Palestine Laboratory. And it essentially is an investigation on Israel's exportation of technology and testing it out in Palestine and then repurposing it for other systems and making itself a worthy partner to largely Western states and making massive profit as a result.
Listeners, you are listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA Radio. We're in conversation with Petra Molnar, whose latest book is called The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. We have about 10 minutes left, Petra, and so I want to shift gears a little bit and go back to this conversation about algorithms and what artificial intelligence really does when it is brought into these contexts, but also how it's developed. Most of the algorithmic codes are very proprietary by private companies and therefore private or secret. And so it can be very hard to understand how an artificial intelligence decision came to be. If we're talking about the example you just gave by the government of Israel, we're literally talking about how a gun decided to shoot someone.
Yeah.
How can we reckon with the intense lack of transparency around AI? And I would say this certainly involves border technology, but also AI in any context that we're dealing with it.
Yeah, there's a lot to say there. I mean, the transparency piece is such a crucial part of all of this. And I know we touched on it when we were talking about the kind of transparency around knowing what, you know, governments are introducing and how your own particular case can be impacted by tech. But it's also about understanding what actually makes up these technologies, which data sets are used, you know, how are decisions rendered and why. And the fact that so much of this is proprietary and, you know, hidden by the private sector and also sometimes transnational partnerships, right? It becomes very difficult to be able to lift the hood, so to speak, and actually critique what is happening on the inside, right? But I think in the border space and in migration, again, the context is so key because immigration decision-making is already opaque. It is already discretionary. You know, legally speaking, you can have two different officers look at the exact same set of evidence and render two completely different yet equally legally valid decisions. So if there's so much discretion already there, imagine what happens when you start augmenting or replacing immigration decision-making by humans with some sort of machine learning. It just really obfuscates responsibility even more. And that's one of the concerns, the fact that a lot of this technology can create a further veil, right, between the powerful actors who are making decisions and the people who are often harmed by them. Because even when you start thinking about it from a perspective of, well, how can I actually challenge these decisions? You know, if, for example, you are deported as a result of an algorithm that made a mistake, like, who are you actually challenging legally, right? Is it the person who coded the algorithm? Is it the immigration officer who used it? Is it the algorithm itself? Can an algorithm be guilty like that? Or should it have a legal personality in a court of law? I mean, all of these questions are coming up in some of the most high-risk situations possible, right? At the border, in criminal justice and sentencing, right? That's where we see algorithmic decision-making too. Welfare algorithms. It always seems to be weaponized towards groups that have historically been marginalized, and that's no accident.
You know, as these tools develop so rapidly, certainly we don't have the government intention for it at this time at most wealthy and powerful countries that are using these technologies. But is it even possible for regulatory measures to address technology at the rate that it's being developed and implemented? And is it possible to create safeguards against whatever the next development in AI border security is?
Yeah, you know, that's such a good point, and you're absolutely right. You know, like for me, as someone who does this for a living, it's impossible to keep up now with the kind of level of innovation and all the different projects that are being created on a daily basis. And law, you know, is slow. Governance making is slow, and in a way, as it should be, right? Because it needs to be representative of the current situation, but also be forward-looking a little bit in terms of, you know, what's kind of coming down the pipe. And it makes it very difficult to have regulation that is responsive to this kind of techno-solutionistic moment that we're in, you know. But when we're looking at it from a legal perspective, and, you know, I'll put my lawyer hat on for a second. I'm a reluctant lawyer, but still a lawyer. You know, we've been seeing some promising trends. For example, in the European Union, they just ratified in August their long-awaited Act to Regulate Artificial Intelligence, or the AI Act. This was years in the making, and it's this kind of omnibus bill that tries to create some guardrails around AI. But unfortunately, and perhaps unsurprisingly, again, given the kind of political context around migration, it doesn't really go far enough at all on border technologies. And that in and of itself is sad and troubling for, you know, rights holders and people who are going to be harmed by this. But it's also troubling from a geopolitical perspective, because it would have set a global precedent on the governance of AI. And so if the EU's AI Act is pretty weak, you know, countries like the United States and Canada and Australia don't really have an incentive to regulate either. And so that's why we're seeing not a lot of guardrails when it comes to border technology specifically, but like technology generally, because the dominant narrative seems to be that more innovation is always better. Private sector actors have a massive influence over what we innovate on and why. And the law just isn't there. And, you know, I think so much of it is also complicated by the fact that, you know, to be perfectly frank, like we can't even seem to agree on banning autonomous weapons, right? How are we going to agree on, you know, banning border technologies or creating a moratorium, you know, or something like that? It's a complex conversation, and I'm not really sure where it's going to go when it comes to the kind of guardrails that we really desperately need in this sector.
When we're thinking about border enforcement and immigration enforcement and how AI is aiding these processes in extremely violent ways, I think it's worthwhile to recognize that these technologies that are being used don't only apply to the people who are seeking refuge in that context. As we move through the world, we interact with these types of technologies regularly. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the potential to opt out of certain types of facial recognition processes at an airport. I'm wondering if you can reflect on how those of us who are going about our daily lives and not engaging with various border enforcement agencies are interacting with these systems and what ways there might be for us to either opt out or also resist and reject the framework of it.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And you know, I think it's clear that, you know, I think borders and migration are such an important context to focus on specifically, right? Because of the sharp impact, the harms to communities, but they're also spaces where this technology is tested out. But the thing is, it doesn't just stay there, right? Even some of the most draconian sci-fi technology that we were talking about, like the RoboDogs, you know, a year after they were announced at the U.S.-Mexico border, the New York City Police Department, on TikTok, no less, made an announcement that they wanted to use RoboDogs on the streets of New York City to keep New York safe. And one was even painted white with black spots on it, like a Dalmatian. So there is this kind of bleed over, right, of border technologies that then make their way into other spaces of public life. I'm also thinking about, for example, you know, facial recognition in sports stadiums, or, you know, the surveillance of protesters and protest movements. This technology, again, is not just for the border, but it's normalized there and then bleeds over elsewhere. And so, you know, I think so much of this conversation is perhaps about, you know, a few things. One, about learning what is happening, what kind of technologies are used, and also what our rights are to say, no, we don't want this on our streets. We don't want this in our communities. And, you know, I was maybe sounding a bit despondent when you asked me about the governance and the lawmaking and all of that. You know, I do think one way forward is municipal action and localized action. There have been cities in the United States that have banned facial recognition and biometric mass surveillance on their streets because people say, no, we don't want this here. And I think that is a way forward. So much of it is about also maybe not falling for the kind of politics of difference and fear that, you know, policymakers have become very good at, kind of pitting communities against one another, because we are all impacted by this.
One of the suggestions that you made in the book is that the tech community must push the conversation beyond reform and toward abolition of technologies that cause harm. Abolition is often a politic that requires imaginative thinking. When you think of abolition of technologies, of these types of technologies, what's your vision?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and such a good reminder that we need to make space for dream making, right, in the conversations that we have about what a completely different world could look like. And, you know, when we think about abolition and the border industrial complex and borders in general, you know, I think we can push the conversation forward and say, well, what would a borderless world look like? And in the specific examples around technology, I mean, you know, I don't think it's as radical as some people think it is, right? I mean, do we want RoboDogs at our borders? Do we want AI lie detectors? You know, I think most people would say no. It's also about tapping into the kind of, I don't know, human conversations that we need to have about the impacts of this technology and what kind of world we're actually wanting to be living in.
You know, one of the things you were talking about just a little bit ago that you reminded me of is how much technology develops to support war making. I think border enforcement fits within that framework. But then we see that technology grounded into our streets, whether it's with the New York police bringing in a spotted RoboDog. I'm going to have to wrap us up, but before we end, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the Migration and Technology Monitor.
Oh, thank you so much. I think that's a great maybe thing to end on, because at the Migration Technology Monitor, we try and imagine a different world. It is a collective of people who are concerned about the impacts of technology at the border and in migration, and we incubate projects and work by colleagues on the move who are really the ones with lived experience of what is currently happening at the world's borders and for those also living under occupation. And it's been really, you know, amazing to see the breadth of projects that people work on, because, you know, while there are colleagues on the move who are looking at things like surveillance and the kind of discriminatory impacts of, for example, the CBP1 facial recognition app at the U.S.-Mexico border, there are also those who are using technologies and developing tools for and by mobile communities to aid in empowerment, in information sharing, in the creation of psychosocial archives. You know, technology also does have the power to liberate, but it's ultimately about who's around the table when we innovate and when we dream up these projects. And I think that's ultimately what we're trying to change at the Migration Technology Monitor, the kind of ways that knowledge is produced and expertise is curated, and actually paying attention to who the real experts with lived experience are that have to be driving the conversation around what we innovate on and why.
Well, we here at KPFA and Law and Disorder certainly appreciate that work. Petra, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you for joining us today on Law and Disorder. And very briefly, how can people learn about the Migration and Technology Monitor and perhaps check it out more?
So you can go to our website, which is actually a platform in four languages. We operate in Arabic, French, Spanish, and English. We're also on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
All right, Petra, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We've been in conversation with Petra Molnar, a lawyer and anthropologist specializing on the impacts of migration technologies. She co-runs the Refugee Law Lab at York University and the Migration and Technology Monitor, which funds community-grounded projects on border tech. Her book is called The Walls Have Eyes: Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.